the echo chamber is affecting us all. It's affecting us in the heterodox space. It's affecting us on the right. It's affecting us in whatever community we're in. It's affecting me. I mean, the thing, you know, I have to spend every day working hard, I know, to not be inside an echo chamber. We look at our phones and we think that we're looking through a window onto the world, but it's actually a mirror that's just reflecting back our own biases and preconceptions. The job of our life, the job of our generation, is to find a way through the madness of algorithms and the madness of crowds and come out with, you know, our heads screwed on.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Josh Zepps. Josh, welcome to the show.
So lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I'm looking forward to us possibly having an uncomfortable conversation, or maybe not.
Those are always the best kind, Brendan.
They're
always
the best kind. And I suppose to kick it off, I want to ask you what an uncomfortable conversation is. Now, some listeners will be familiar with you from your podcast of that very name, where you have conversations with people who, I think it's fair to say, people who are breaking out of the echo chamber or trying to think a bit differently about culture and politics and society. And what is it about the discomfort in these conversations that you think is important? Why do you think those kinds of chats are important now?
Well, just to clarify, the discomfort in the conversation itself may not be important, and it isn't something that I always strive to foster. Like, some people think that because the show is called Uncomfortable Conversations, that means that I'm always going to try to manufacture some kind of discomfort with the guest. As regular listeners will know, most of the conversations are quite amicable. But the uncomfortableness lies in the fact that we will talk about issues which, if someone were to express a strident opinion about them at an office event or a pub or a dinner party, everyone's anuses would just pucker up a little bit and people would feel a bit uncomfortable, right? And we will heedlessly go and have those conversations, and we won't worry about treading on eggshells, and we won't worry about triggering tripwires. And as to the importance of that, I mean, I don't actually think there's anything more important in the 21st century. Like, I mean, we face a lot of challenges to get through this century as a civilization, as, you know, and as a cohesive demos, and in a way that permits the flourishing of liberal democracy. And I'm not sure how we do that unless we actually talk in a frank and honest and bullshit-free way with each other about the most important issues of our time, instead of sweeping them under the carpet or trying to impose some kind of orthodoxy or groupthink, or sitting inside our comfortable echo chambers and pointing fingers at how terrible people on the other side are. Like, I just think fostering some level of, I guess, empathic imagination, you know, epistemological humility, some people call it, like recognition of our own, of the fallibility of our own assumptions and the ways in which we're probably blinded from all kinds of conversations and points of view that might be happening in amongst different cohorts, and being as generous as possible towards the way that other people think. Like, I think those fundamental sort of small L liberal precepts are the only way we get out of this thing alive.
Well, that's a very good description of what we try to do here at the Brendan O'Neill Show as well, which is to have those conversations that are usually often amicable, but not afraid to venture into supposedly uncomfortable territory. When I listened to your podcast, and you had a great conversation with Stephen Fry, you've had Niall Ferguson on talking about, well, the collapse of civilization or the changing nature of civilization. You've had great conversations, and I listen to them and I think to myself, actually, today, those kinds of conversations might be rare, although I think they're becoming more common because there is more of an appetite for long-form conversations on serious issues in which people are not afraid to speak their minds. But when I listen to them, I also think to myself, that's what conversations used to be like. So if you watch kind of TV talk shows, political shows from the 60s or the 70s, and this could be in Australia or America or the UK, people used to have conversations like this. They used to have fairly long form conversations. You might have a guest like Susan Sontag or Clive James or Jermaine Greer, some brilliant mind, talking about the world in depth and not afraid to say things that the audience might gasp at. And so it's like, it feels like you're rehabilitating an old form of conversation. And I wonder if you, why you think that got lost somewhere down the line. How did we lose the knack for having those kinds of in-depth conversations where if you feel offended, that's okay?
I think that's interesting. I mean, that's such an interesting question because there are so many different reasons for it. I mean, I think there are a couple of things going on. One is that I actually think we could do a better job in this sort of intellectual space of having the conversations where we play devil's advocate and we push back against people, even if they are on our own side. So I do try to make a point of kind of burnishing my journalistic bona fides by making sure that even if there's someone who I do agree with, that I push back. And I think I'm always trying to use my imagination to think, what would the person who is not already on this person's side, even if I am, be objecting to right now? And I try to put that case just to hear them wrestle with a challenge. And I actually think there's too little of that sometimes in this quote unquote heterodox space where you've got a lot of podcasts and YouTube shows where, you know, we're smashing the woke, you know, consensus by speaking bravely about all the things that you're supposedly not allowed to say, but it actually ends up being hours and hours of people agreeing with each other about, you know, how ridiculous it is that we all have to put transgender pronouns in our email signatures. Like, that to me is not terribly interesting. Like, we get it. And I think that what part of the shame is that the people who are best equipped to do this, which is the sort of traditional journalism class, have found themselves a bit hamstrung by the moral panic of the social justice revolution, or what you might call, you know, the great awakening of the past 5 or 10 years. So that where they would normally fearlessly ask that provocative question on certain issues, if it comes to immigration, if it comes to the Me Too movement, if it comes to gender, if it comes to what is appropriate or inappropriate in the workplace between men and women and what the punishments should be and whether there are degrees of transgression that we should be able to talk about there, about who has standing to talk about such things, about, you know, diversity, about the way that, about representation, all of these things. If, I mean, we all know that there is this kind of university educated, mostly white sort of guilty post-colonial elite consensus that regards itself as being on the correct side of history. And for a real journalist to do real journalism, which would be to play devil's advocate against that orthodoxy and try to puncture that dogma, would be perceived as being a bit unseemly, you know, a bit sort of, why are you constantly trying to cause trouble? Why are you trying to denigrate traditionally marginalized or disadvantaged communities of color or something? You know, it would always end up getting framed that way. So that would be my explanation, that there are two things going on. The people who are good at doing real journalism find themselves in a highly censorious moment where it's hard to be brave. And the people who are brave aren't necessarily well-trained at being good journalists.
Yeah, that's very well put. And that neatly brings me on to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is the question of journalism and what's happening with journalism. Now, you worked with the ABC in Australia. You became famous on, you were even in the Daily Mail, which of course everyone reads on the internet, when you stepped down.
I love
live
that.
That's
the yardstick of celebrity, the Daily Mail.
I was very happy once when I made it into the Daily Mail's column of shame on the right hand side over something I wrote, and they were very outraged about it. I'm a big fan of the Daily Mail, I should say. You had this radio show on ABC in Australia. I've been to Australia many times. I want to ask you a couple of questions about Australia in a minute. Whenever I have to describe the ABC to friends of mine here in the UK, I often say it's like the BBC, but even worse, even more worthy and even more annoying, if you can imagine that. That's been my experience. I'm sure they have lots of good qualities too. But you resigned live on air and you gave a monologue and you said, you suggested that you were possibly a bit too spicy for this kind of thing, and you weren't going to bullshit the audience. You were going to say to them, look, I'm being honest with you. I'm moving on. I want to do something else. What was the reason that you did that in particular? Was it something specific to the ABC that was ticking you off, or is it a broader problem with mainstream journalism these days, as you just said, which kind of crushes you in and makes it difficult to have those kinds of conversations?
It's a broader problem. It's definitely a broader problem. I mean, I would dispute your characterization of the ABC as being even more worthy than the BBC. The ABC is a multifaceted beast, right? And I do personally regard public broadcasting as being indispensable. I think it's really useful to have a place that is free both from corporate influence and supposedly from government influence. But it needs to be courageous enough to be a genuine town square where issues are really wrestled with, rather than becoming an echo chamber for elites to reinforce to each other and signal to each other how virtuous they are on a specific set of issues. Now, I don't think that that is what the ABC or the BBC really spend the majority of their time doing, but I just do have that sort of strain in me that always wants to ask the uncomfortable question and have the uncomfortable conversation. I mean, I'm just allergic to consensus and sort of easy answers. I always want to, you know, take the contrarian approach if possible. And look, a public broadcaster is really hard for big organizations, certainly over the past 5 or 10 years, to not be risk averse, corporatized, hyper cautious, you know, just not want to cause trouble. Like, that is just an institutional managerial imperative, regardless of where you are. And I felt that at the time there were a series of sort of run-ins, and, you know, to say that the decision to leave was entirely my own would be a lie. It's like, you know, these things are complicated. And I think there was just a point at which it was clear that either you're on the team or you can go off and do your own bloody thing. You know, you don't have to always be the person who makes life difficult for people who know that we're on the right side of history, be that about Indigenous rights or, you know, immigration or trans issues or whatever, or gay pride, which was probably the initial moment where I realized that there was a disjoint between the way that I wanted to speak and the way that it was appropriate for somebody who was a public face of the public broadcaster to speak. I think this also exists on the other side, that you have right-wing echo chambers and you have kind of an institutionalization of conservative orthodoxies. It's very difficult to go on a right-wing cable network and be critical of Israel, or, you know, I mean, there are a whole, you know, to talk about the costs and hassles of climate chaos without being considered like you're tarred as if you're Greta Thunberg herself. So I think we all have our blind spots. But there's just something about this sort of crisscrossing network of elites who occupy the universities, the media, and I suppose the public service, that I felt like I had to escape.
You know, I don't disagree with your description there of the role of the public broadcaster, because I've always thought that the ideal of public broadcasting is a good ideal, which is to have a broadcaster that is above the kind of corporate fray, so it doesn't have to bow to the profit motive, but tries to produce journalism for a higher purpose or a higher reason than that, and which also is ostensibly independent of government. And sometimes public broadcasters are independent of government, other times less so. That's a good ideal, but my view of the BBC, and I think also the ABC, about which I know a lot less than the BBC, I think what's happening to them is that they feel like public broadcasters that are ever more estranged from the public. So, you know, when I go into the BBC to do something or other, you have conversations with people that are very, very different to the kinds of conversations I would have with a family member or a friend or people down the pub. And similarly with my experiences with the ABC, when I've been on Q&A, for example, and you're in the green room and people look at you like you're an alien because you're saying something that you yourself consider to be perfectly reasonable and which, you know, people in the pub would nod along with you. But when you say it there in that space, people look at you as like, where did you come from? Why are you saying this? So do you think there's an issue where one of the problems with public broadcasting, and you have a lot of experience of it, is that it has become, it's rising further and further above not just the corporate fray and government pressure, but the public itself?
Yes, but I also think that these are complicated institutions with many factions inside them, some of which recognize precisely that problem. And, you know, I was there and I recognized that problem. And my boss's boss's boss, who was at a director level, she recognized that problem. And in fact, you know, to the ABC's credit, I was the last person that had to sort of sever ties under the previous regime. And then the managing director who made the captain's call on my employment ultimately and made that untenable was booted out. And there's now a new chair of the ABC, huge reforms and ruptures. They're basically, I mean, it's entirely possible that if we had time shifted this whole thing by 12 months, that I would have found that the faction that recognizes the problem that you're talking about was ascendant, in fact. So, it's not monolithic. I hold out hope for it. I mean, I would also just say that I think something has happened in the past 10 years, 5 or 10 years, that is specific to our time, which I think public broadcasters could recover from, which is that we've had difficulty understanding what diversity means. Like, I think it's clear that there has been a laudable attempt to try to make the public broadcasters less stuffy, middle-aged, white, and male by hiring more, young women of color and people from diverse backgrounds and so on. And I think that's a good thing, but I don't think that you should be able to use that to smuggle in an idea that everybody's own lived experience is a valid form of journalism and that their own ethnic background or their gender or their sex or their sexuality should be informing their reporting and informing their conversations. And that is what has happened. And I think that is contributing to your sense of it being somewhat detached from the normal conversations that people have, because it's like, it's not only is it a little bit up its own bum in the kind of left-wing cliquey way, but it's also hewing to quite a dogmatic set in interpretation of diversity. I mean, we would have spreadsheets on my radio show to track the diversity metrics of the guests who are on the show, and they say, well, of course, how are you going to measure whether or not you're doing well against your aspirational diversity targets if you don't measure it? So fine, let's waste producers' time filling out a spreadsheet of diversity metrics. But those metrics are all things like ethnicity, linguistically diverse background, culturally diverse background, race, sexuality. You don't have a column on the spreadsheet for political affiliation, for class, for whether you went to a private or public school, for whether you come from a regional town or from a city, your ideology, right? Those matter in reflecting a country to itself, in creating a big, rambunctious town square, because you might have a panel, where you've got one Sikh woman and one Muslim woman and one Indigenous woman and one woman of African descent, but they're all saying the same thing. They all have the same attitude towards the question of whether or not Australia or the United Kingdom are irredeemably racist countries. And sometimes you do need the other point of view, and it doesn't fall along a neat diversity metric. So I hold out hope, actually, Brendan, that moment is waning, and that we're ready for a conversation about a richer understanding of what public broadcasting is, of what actual diversity is, of what real representation is, of what real pluralism is, and that public broadcasters like the ABC, especially under its new management, will come around. And, I would be the first person to jump back on board and to help make that happen when it does.
Is the exact same problem at the BBC and other institutions. In fact, we don't need to pick on the BBC and the ABC in the way that I've been doing, in the sense that there's this obsession with diversity, but it never involves intellectual diversity or political diversity, or, as you say, class diversity. And as you say, it has this knock-on effect, ironically, of making an institution potentially less diverse, because the more they become obsessed with the ideology of diversity rather than the reality of it, the more they kind of become beholden to the whole ethos of DEI, and anyone who criticizes it risks being elbowed out. So the push to diversity can actually make a workplace less intellectually diverse, less substantially diverse in the way people think.
Yeah. No, I mean, the class thing's really interesting as well, because I was just having a conversation on the podcast with Musa Al-Garbi. I don't know if you know Musa, but Musa's a black Muslim American professor and sociologist who's written a really interesting book about all this stuff. And his point was basically that the elites, what we might call the woke elite, but he's not crazy about that term, and nor am I, because it's just turned into a cudgel that anyone can use against anything they don't like. But that the elites have sort of self-selected a category of upper middle class people of color to be spokespeople for those communities. And they're actually, they have a lot more in common than the with the white elites than they do with anybody, with your, you know, your average or median person of color in the United States or the UK or Australia. So there's this set of, and actually when the actual people from the genuinely disadvantaged or marginalized communities express points of view at the ballot box that differ from what the appointed elites from those communities say they should think, we just disregard them as if they have some kind of false consciousness. Oh, Latinos in America want to vote for Donald Trump because they want, you know, a border wall. They must be mistaken, because here we have our Latinx correspondent at the New York Times who says that Donald Trump is a racist and hates Hispanics. So who are you going to believe? Actual Hispanics or our in-house Hispanic who can do all the talking for them? You know, it's ridiculous. And it does show how class and education and prosperity and connections can work for, you know, essentially absolve us of the need to do any real work about diversity.
I think on that question, you can often tell who's the kind of in-house self-selected Latino spokesperson by whether they call themselves Latinx. And, you know, if they're Latinx, they're part of the kind of inner circle. If they're Latino, then I think they're probably more worth listening to. On that question, I think that's a good point, because it often seems to me that one of the ironies of exactly what you describe, which is that there are these elements of the kind of upper middle class sections of Black communities or indigenous communities or other ethnic minority communities, when they are pushed to the surface to give the correct view, supposedly, that can actually contribute to a culture of racial paternalism or racial judgment. So I was on The Moral Maze on the BBC here in Britain a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about Jamie Oliver's new children's book, which has caused a big storm because there's a section in it about Indigenous Australians, and one of the Indigenous children gets taken away or something like that. But apparently, according to Indigenous spokespeople in Australia, it was offensively written. It wasn't culturally sensitive. And as a consequence of that, the book has been completely withdrawn from sale and pulped. I mean, it's one of the most extraordinary acts of kind of woke censorship, for want of a better word, that we've seen. And I was discussing this on The Moral Maze, and there was a spokesperson from an Indigenous think tank, I think, and he was saying this book is mortifyingly offensive. We hate it. It's got to go. It's got to be destroyed. And I tried to push back by saying, look, the Indigenous people I know in Australia probably don't give a damn that Jamie Oliver has written a kid's book. Even if they did care to pick it up and read it, they probably wouldn't melt into a puddle of, you know, tears at this apparently badly written chapter. So you get this situation where it's like a new form of racism, because groups get presented as so fragile and so weak that they need to be protected from offence by the self-elected representatives of their community. When in fact, the Indigenous people I know in Australia are incredibly robust. They need to be, because of all the things they've been through and still go through. And so you have this incredible paternalism coming through this kind of diversity politics. And you see that in some of the discussion about Indigenous issues.
A really interesting insight that relates to that came out in an episode recently with Tim Minchin. If people don't know Tim Minchin, he's a great Australian musician and comedian. He wrote Matilda, the West End show, and the musical movie. And that's would actually be a good episode to start with if you're new to the show, either Stephen Fry or Tim Minchin, because they're both quite sort of philosophical, you know, really interesting exchanges where we get our hands dirty. And one point that he made is that when it's interesting to notice the groups to whom we give our sympathy and the groups to whom we ascribe agency. And it'll tell you a lot about your kind of paternalism towards a certain group, depending on whether you frame their actions through a prism of sympathy or agency. So what's being done there, and I can't really comment about the Jamie Oliver thing, because I can imagine a scenario in which a white English chef trying to be woke blunders in really, you know, in really clumsy ways that actually are just sort of foul and he should never have tried in the first place. So I can, I'm not necessarily saying that means that his book should be pulped, but I can totally imagine the scenario in which that goes awry. Nonetheless, the attitude that you're pointing to of believing that there's a community that is so fragile that they will clutch their pearls if they see a cookbook from a writer on the other side of the world who's obviously just trying to be sort of nice, but he doesn't do so in precisely the way in which they would want him to. You're basically saying that they don't have agency over their own emotions. They don't have the capacity and the emotional maturity to roll with the punches in the way that other people do, certainly the way that white people do, or the way that, cisgendered, heterosexual white males supposedly do. And similarly, when you can look at almost any conflict and you can understand a lot about yourself by trying to detect to whom you give agency and who you feel sympathy for. So, we were talking about the Middle East with Tim Minchin. There is a tendency on the left to regard the Palestinians as noble victims entirely, right? They don't have agency. Arabs don't have agency in the anti-Zionist worldview. They are the victims of colonialism, they're the victims of Western imperialism, of the corruption of the Zionist state, of settlers coming in and driving them out. What can you expect of them? But of course they would, erupt in the form of a jihadist death cult, because what could you possibly expect them to do? They're Palestinians. On the other side, enormous agency is ascribed to the Israelis, who are whitish, Westernish, and ought to know better than to be dropping bombs on innocent children. And it's that strange double standard where, the reality is all of us have agency and all of us deserve sympathy, and we should cut everyone a bit of slack and also expect the most of them.
Absolutely. I really agree with that analysis of the approach to the Middle East. I've referred to it as a kind of almost like a double racism, because on the one hand, you have this feverish obsession, in my view, with Israel as being the author of every ill in the Middle East and potentially lots of ills in the world itself. So Israel is kind of all those sins are projected onto Israel. And then on the other side, you have this infantilization of Palestinians and Arabs. And even 7th of October gets discussed almost like an understandable tantrum by kids who've been pushed about. So the agency of the people who made the decision to plan that attack, to carry it out, to continue carrying it out by keeping the hostages, that agency is completely washed away in this kind of approach that demonizes Israel and infantilizes Arabs. And you just think neither one of these approaches is appropriate for this part of the world.
It's interesting. Just on that, one person sent me an email, an old friend of mine in New York, after listening to this particular episode with Tim Minchin, and said that during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings in the United States, who is a Supreme Court justice who was sort of dragged through the mud for allegedly being a bit of a brat and too handsy, and I can't remember the precise details of sexual impropriety when he was in college. But there were literal inquiries into this where it was all aired in public. And this guy was at the same college as Kavanaugh at the same time and was saying, what struck me about that was that there was none of the usual sense from the left that you have to understand people in the context of their time and upbringing. When it comes to the social justice left, we spend a lot of time, and I put myself sort of broadly on the left. I mean, I am a creature of the center left, essentially, and I still believe in a class-based view of society, and I believe in using the tools of the state to try to create as egalitarian a playing field as we can. But I have no time for the nonsense of the social justice ideologies and dogmas and religions that have bubbled up recently and have shifted our focus from economic justice towards identity politics. But nonetheless, on the social justice left, you certainly have this understanding that if a Sudanese Australian gang member commits a crime, that you should take into account the fact that, they were raised in the bloody Sudan, and they have had a really weird life, and it may be difficult for them to acclimatize to the norms of this environment. If an Indigenous Australian man is an alcoholic and he's abusive towards his kids, we don't take glee in hauling him before an inquiry and holding him entirely responsible and ascribing him only agency and no sympathy in his actions. But when it comes to, you know, a straight white privileged potential Supreme Court justice named Brett Kavanaugh, the entire thing is taking place in the context of a left that is gleefully furious and pruriently enraged and kind of salaciously delighted, taking such schadenfreude in the possibility of his downfall, as if the man, as if there's no recognition of the fact that he's a bro, he's a jock from a particular kind of milieu at a particular kind of time when, you know, fooling around in the closet with a girl did not involve overtly asking consent before you did so. And that's not right. And we now know that that's not right. But he wasn't parachuted into the like 1970s or 1980s from the 2020s. He had the same, you know, he had an experience that was formative to him, and he was a creature of his time. And I just thought that was a really interesting way of looking at that double standard.
Okay, you've mentioned class. I do want to ask you about a little bit about that. I want to, firstly, in the Australia context, I find Australia fascinating. I've been there 7 times. I love Australia, and I find it a, I don't know if contradictory is the right word, but it's always struck me that in Australia you have both a greater willingness, I think, than in other countries to push back against bullshit, including political correctness or whatever the hell we're supposed to call it. There is still, you know, D.H. Lawrence in his book Kangaroo, he famously said that no one rules in Australia and no one is supposed to rule. And you still do get that vibe if you go slightly outside of the cities and you encounter people who say, they might say, oh, climate change is bullshit or it's exaggerated. Or they say, look, we love oil. Screw you, city people. We're going to keep digging for oil. And if a, you know, a man who claims to be a woman was to try to go into the women's toilet in their pub, they wouldn't have it. Right. So you have that culture is still there. I hope I'm not caricaturing it because it is real. And then you go into, I don't know, parts of Melbourne or parts of Sydney, and that kind of culture that you're talking about, the social justice left, which we have around the Western world, it's very powerful. It's very, very influential. And I've had the personal experience of giving the same speech in a suburb in Brisbane and getting a huge round of applause, and then doing that speech in the University of Sydney, and people were fainting in the aisles and walking out. You know, it's two worlds. It's two Australias, really. And I just wonder if what's your thoughts on that in relation to the class question as it pertains to people's willingness or unwillingness to go along with some of these ideas? Because it seems to me that there are still huge numbers of ordinary working class people who have a healthy skepticism to some of this, whereas in other parts of society, you kind of have to buy into it if you want to get ahead.
I mean, Australia is weird. I think you're right. I mean, there are lots of strange contradictions about this country. Let me just park the question of class, because there might be another thing that you're seeing that you're not quite noticing, which is Australians' relationship to authority and to that kind of larrikin spirit that you're talking about in the outback, where they're not going to take any shit from anybody, right? There's a really interesting thing about Aussies. We highly resent rules and authority when it comes from a human being. When if someone tells us to do something, we'll say, get stuffed. You're not going to push me around. You're not going to talk to me like that. We have this intrinsic kind of colonial, like penal colony attitude towards authority and pomp and ceremony and the crown and all that. We're rebels. But you put that same instruction on a sign, or you put it in a letter, and we will obey. Extremely high levels of vertical obedience. Speed limits are incredibly strictly enforced. You know, random breathalyzers every Friday and Saturday night all over the place, and people love it. Rules everywhere about everything. I mean, rules in Sydney about what you can drink and when you can drink it and where you can drink it precisely, even inside a bar. You know, obviously COVID is the sort of, you know, ur example of Australian compliance. And so I think there is, I think that may be part of what you're noticing, which is a tension between the rugged individualistic kind of frontier spirit and a deep, and I'm not sure where this comes from. And it's interesting that this kind of trust in hierarchical order is reminiscent of other East Asian countries, certainly more than the United States and probably more than the UK. I'm not sure why the geography of Australia and New Zealand has somehow inherited that characteristic. May be part of like a national sort of psychosis about being stranded a long way away from our allies. I mean, it's conceivable, you know, the argument has been made that when you're surrounded by a billion yellow people, and I put that in quotation marks, of course, that's the, you know, the old colonial idea about the peril that surrounded us. You do have to have a kind of constant vigilance about making sure that everything's in order and you've dotted your I's and you've crossed your T's and, you know, you're doing the right thing by the Crown and you're doing the right thing by Washington, D.C. And you're always on guard because there are hundreds of millions of people in crowded, poor circumstances immediately to your north. I don't know whether that's a correct psychoanalysis, but it sort of smells vaguely true to me that that could be an explanation for why Australian larrikinism and rejection of authority also butts up against its contradictory compliance when it has to. And on the question of wokeness, look, isn't it sort of the same everywhere? I mean, in the sense that there is a working class heartland that just declines to get the memo on this and, you know, to its credit, largely. And there's a certain, I'm not sure that it's necessarily, it doesn't necessarily cleave along economic class lines. It's more of a cultural phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, it really is something to do with the academy and this particular sort of university-educated ideology that has replaced what I would call a real class conversation, meaning a conversation about just how different it is to try to get ahead and realize your dreams and flourish if you're born into grinding poverty than if you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth. That has replaced that conversation with a conversation that assumes that the best way of analyzing culture and society and politics is by looking at it as a set of groups, some of whom have privilege and some of whom don't, some of whom have been marginalized and some of whom have not. And that's the chess move that's taken place in the past 10 years on the left that I think is the better way of looking at it rather than asking, you know, are the upper class woke and the working class not? I don't think that's quite the right distinction.
Yeah. It's interesting where you talk about Australians following rules if they come on a sign or by letter, because the thing that's always struck me about Australia and it drives me insane is people not crossing the road until the green man flashes, even when there are no cars. You can be standing there for like 2 minutes and I'm like, guys, let's go, let's go. This year I went from New York to Sydney and the difference in that cultural approach to crossing the road was extraordinary. In New York, people just walk and walk and walk. They don't care about cars. In Sydney, they're standing there waiting until the sign says, you may now walk across this empty road that has no cars on it. It's extraordinary.
Absolutely. No, I know. I mean, I notice that in the UK, though, I must say as well. You know, not that it's worse, but there's something about, I was just in London last week and, you know, not to disparage your fine nation, but there's something about like the design and architecture of a lot of things that have been built in the past half century in the UK that is soul destroying and makes me feel like I'm a widget in a gigantic machine instead of a human being. Like I can't remember what train station I was at, but it was a train station that was designed it was obviously quite recent. It would have been within the past 20 or 30 years. And it was designed as if the units that were going to be passing through it were just widgets, right, with no individual autonomy, because there would be a passageway where you'd be able to look out an atrium and see where I wanted to go. But I couldn't get there unless I obeyed a counterintuitive sign that told me to go another way. So there's no appreciation for like the individual ingenuity of the human spirit in this place. It's just like, you know, Widget will go from A to B, and if Widget tries to go another way, Widget will find himself in you know, spewed out onto the cab rank, even though I could see that the place where I actually wanted to go was just down there underneath. But you can't get there. I can't get there because I disobeyed the sign. There's something just very dehumanizing about, you know, not just, I'm not just saying in the UK, but about this whole trend to sort of strip us of our sparkle and like get us to conform. And I just think there's a mindset of the planner and the bureaucrat and the apparatchik, I suppose, which is we just need to turn the volume down on all that shit, and turn the volume up on allowing people to do things. I mean, just another anecdote. I was in Switzerland visiting a friend of mine who lives there. He's an Aussie, and there was a raging river of melted glacial water roaring through the middle of one of the towns, and we were crossing a bridge, and these teenage kids were jumping off the bridge into the water. And he and I thought, we're not too old for this yet, and stripped off our t-shirts and jumped into the water, and we're going through this, torrent of water. And I kind of smashed my ass on an underwater rock, and we had to both sort of scramble up the edge of the embankment. We walked all the way back and fetched our t-shirts. And there's the occasional cop just wandering by, people cheerfully sort of had it picnicking and stuff. There were people with open bottles of wine drinking. And I looked at it and I thought, this is banned in Australia. This is absolutely banned. You couldn't have the open bottle of wine in a park unless there was a cordoned off area, which was endorsed by the gendarmes. And there is no way in hell that they would be allowing people to hazardously leap off a bridge into a stream because they don't respect the autonomy, my autonomy, to make that kind of risk calculus for myself. It would have to be, they would put up barricades, they would find the part of the river that was safe. They'd put little flags along the river. They'd have, they'd have security officers with yellow vests who had clipboards of occupational health and safety checklists, funneling people along lines to line up and do it in an orderly fashion. And they'd have a stopwatch to count the number of seconds between each person so that one person couldn't jump on another person's head. You know what I mean? It like, let me live. This is not a political complaint. This is like a cry for sort of cultural libertarianism, I suppose, and respect for the individual that we seem to have lost.
Absolutely. Let me live. It's a good slogan. That's a good one. Okay, Josh, a couple more questions for you. I just want to ask you about the future for, I don't know, progressive politics, left politics. I don't know what we call it, but the kind of thing you mentioned earlier, which is, you come from the left. I also come from the left, but we have no time for what now passes for left-wing politics or certainly SJW stuff. So I guess I want to ask you what happens next. And it's interesting we talk about signage and the planner and the kind of paternalistic attitude, like herd management that they have when they're designing streets and things. One thing that Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, did in Trafalgar Square, he replaced the green man that tells you can cross the road with the female symbol because he wanted to make the city feel more equal. And it was such an interesting thing. And Bill Leake, my old dearly departed friend Bill Leake, did a great cartoon of this where he said it just showed a woman standing by a road for months and months saying, can I cross yet? And she's not allowed to cross until Sadiq Khan gallantly comes in and puts up a female symbol. It makes me think about there's an ironic element to SJW politics, I think, where it presents itself as feministic and pro-gay rights and anti-racist and all those good things. But actually, it's very often the opposite of that. So it has sometimes a misogynistic undertone, particularly the way in which it treats women who are critical of trans issues, for example. It has a racial undertone, as we've already talked about, that kind of racial paternalism. It even has an homophobic undertone, I think. And I think through the trans question and through the extension of LGB through to TQ and everything else, it's kind of, there is a situation now, sadly, where young gay people in particular often find themselves on a conveyor belt to bodily correction or medical correction because apparently there's something wrong with them. You never thought you'd find yourself in a world in which, young lesbians were being submitted for surgery on the basis that, maybe they're men. I mean, to my mind, that's an extraordinarily homophobic idea. So we have found ourselves in this weird world. And one of the things you criticize, you mentioned it earlier, or you've raised questions about pride and the purpose of pride. And I just wanted to ask you what you think SJW politics means for those kinds of campaigns that were central to the left in the 60s and the 70s, gay liberation, women's liberation, Have they just got confused about those things? Are they now doing it wrong? How do you understand that?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it points to a larger umbrella question, which is one of universalism versus identitarianism. I mean, I'm a universalist. That is why I think that the left was appealing initially. It had universalist human values and thought that all of us deserved equal protection, and that all of us, you know, had, if not the same amount to offer, then deserved the same opportunity to prove whether or not we did have the same, what we could offer. And unfortunately, that has fallen by the wayside, and there's more of a sense now of, rather than trying to expand the whole pie for everybody, trying to slice off pieces of the pie in as favorable a way for the particular identity group that you're most concerned about. On the LGBT question, I'm married to a guy, so I think I have my bona fides on this matter. One of the ways in which I made a bunch of enemies last year was by writing an op-ed, an opinion piece in one of the newspapers. It was initially not even published because my employer wouldn't allow it to be, which was critical of Pride. I mean, I was basically just saying, will there ever come a point at which it's actually more conducive to the sexual flourishing of a 15-year-old to turn the volume down on sexual difference rather than constantly exaggerating it? Like, you know, will there ever come a point at which Pride isn't necessary, at which it's such a non-issue to be gay, at which we've won all of the civil rights that we ever asked for? I mean, we already have. There is no more legal discrimination that one can point to. So once you got to a position, you know, and I'm not talking about if you're in Indonesia or Nigeria, yes, absolutely, do gay pride. You still need it. There are a lot of hearts and minds still to be won over. But if you're in Sydney or London or New York, what exactly are we doing? And does it risk actually impeding the kind of individual flourishing of young people to insist that every urge or romantic, you know, motivation that they might have towards someone of the same sex means that they have to reevaluate their entire identity and open up a whole Pandora's box of identity issues, and that they need to join a club that has a very certain way of speaking and a particular way of dancing and a specific way of voting and a specific way of thinking, that, you know, you're not really a member of the club unless you've worn arseless chaps and straddled a giant inflatable penis down the street, you know, on one bid for a fabulous parade. This is becoming, it's becoming cartoon-like, the way that we have to pledge our fealty towards particular identities. That was my basic point, and that was regarded as being too provocative and too controversial a position for me to take. Not to mention the fact that, you know, I'm the only person who was at my employer at the time in that position who was openly gay. But nonetheless, that didn't give me sufficient standing. So in terms of where the left goes from here, I think that, like, compare, you mentioned trans. I do think we're at risk of entering a moment of anti-trans hysteria if we're not already there. I mean, I think that the criticisms that the J.K. Rowlings of the world were making 2 years ago were really important, because I think there was a climate of real censoriousness around this. And, you know, people were getting fired. Women were getting fired just for questioning whether or not it's true that trans women are women or whatever. On the other hand, I think that taboo has fallen away. I get the sense that that's not a taboo the way that it was. I get a sense that with the closure of the Tavistock Clinic and the reevaluation of the way that medical treatments, particularly pediatric medical treatments, are conducted now, that there's much more caution, certainly outside of the United States. So now I worry that we're just sort of providing an avenue in which people who are a bit transphobic can, you know, express their bigotry in a way that sounds like it's actually a concern for children, when in fact it's just a sort of distaste for trans people. So I would just encourage us to be cautious about that, and to only give it the amount of attention that it actually needs. But in analyzing sociologically what went wrong with the trans civil rights movement, it is interesting to compare it to the gay civil rights movement. The gay civil rights movement would have to be the most successful civil rights movement, probably of all time, in its speed and ferocity of success. I mean, when I was born, you know, being gay was in many places illegal, and everywhere was a deviancy and a perversion. And the idea that it would be legitimate, let alone legal to marry a member of the same sex, was inconceivable. And that was in progressive circles, in progressive countries. And what the gay rights activists of, I guess, the starting in the late 60s, but really through to the 80s and 90s did, was universalize the gay experience. They didn't ask your auntie and your grandma to envisage precisely what gay males do in the bedroom and endorse it and condone it. They didn't march with signs that said, you know, I believe in anal sex or something like that. You know, what they did was they said, we want the same things that you do. We want to be able to rent an apartment without being discriminated against. We want to be able to visit our life partners in hospital when they're on their deathbeds without being excluded and treated as if we're just a stranger. We want to be able to get a loan without being discriminated against. You know, we want to be able to merge our financial affairs. And eventually we want the credibility that marriage provides. You know, you all understand why marriage is valuable, and we believe it is too. Contrast that to the strategy of the most extreme trans activists over the past 10 or 15 years, which has not been a conversation about we want what everybody else wants. We just want to be left alone and we want to have the same legal rights. What it has been is we need you to morally and linguistically endorse everything about the way that we see the world. We need our definition of sex and gender to be your definition. Like, you need to change the way that you think. You need to not only change, but if you can't change, you at least need to sort of mouth Stalinist platitudes that show that we've won and you've lost. And you need to, you know, spout tautologies like, you know, trans women are women. Well, either tautologies or contradictions, depending on your point of view. That's been disastrous and calamitous. And I think that is a microcosm of what you're talking about in terms of the left becoming far too obsessed with purity tests, condescension, censoriousness, what you might call cancel culture, and not nearly obsessed enough with what actually achieves social change and cultural change, which is winning hearts and minds, being reasonable, finding common ground, being upfront and honest and bullshit free, and addressing people's legitimate concerns where they exist and saying, all right, I understand that you're a bit worried that your primary school aged daughter might not have a safe space in her bathroom if, you know, biological males are allowed in. So let's address that, instead of saying you're a transphobic bigot for even raising the question. That's not what the gay rights movement did. And it's not the, you know, it's just simply not, we know through evidence that it's not the way that you achieve lasting change. So the left has to, and I hope is, getting the memo on that when it comes to cultural issues. And I hope that the last US election will make them get the memo on economic questions as well. Like, you have to be able to speak to the heartland. You have to be able to talk about bread and butter issues for people who are supposed to be the constituency of the left. That is working people. You know, it's really peculiar to me that working people are essentially now the constituency. The working people and the very rich are the right. And the left is now a coalition, you know, a minority coalition of the middle class, of the cosmopolitan urbane middle class. That's got to change.
Yeah, it seems to me that we've gone from, on the left, I suppose, they've gone from a politics of liberation to validation. So, you know, previous movements were for the right of people to live freely as they chose without facing persecution or oppression or discrimination. And what we have now in the trans movement, but also other movements, is not a demand for liberation, but a demand for recognition, validation. You have to agree with them that they're the most oppressed people in the world. You have to agree that they are, I don't know, gender fluid and their pronouns are Ziza, whatever. And that creates a much more authoritarian climate, because it makes the person himself, you know, kind of existentially dependent on the validation of other people. and it puts pressure on other people to obey the language, to obey the linguistic rules. So it creates a really difficult climate. Okay, Josh, my final question for you is on, I guess, the future of conversation. You are a conversationalist. You have uncomfortable conversations. How do you think things will go on that front? I was very interested in something you said earlier, that even in the heterodox arena, there are tendencies towards echo chambers. I think there are also tendency towards bad ideas that I don't agree with. And if they are truly heterodox, there should be the scope to discuss that, as well as slagging off the other side. So there are, I think, problems within the anti-echo chamber movement, which risks becoming its own echo chamber, I think. But at the same time, there are positive developments. I think the victory of Trump in America, whatever one might think of Trump, is probably going to have a global impact on the things we are allowed to say, the things we are allowed to think. I think it's probably going to cause a bit of an intellectual wave in the Western world, at least. So that's an upside. So there are, I think, probably good things and bad things happening in the world of conversations. How do you see things progressing?
I unfortunately think they're going to get worse before they get better. I'd respectfully disagree with you on Trump, because I think that in addition to his inflaming the left, he's probably, so, you know, on the one hand, I think he's going to vastly derange and derail the progress of the left towards the vision that I was just articulating, because, you know, everyone's heads explode and then they hunker down into their corners. You know, he's not a figure who fosters greater harmony and comity and compromise. And secondly, I think you might be being too kind towards his allies' censoriousness and attacks on free speech as well from the right. I think, and then thirdly, I also think that there's a danger in algorithmically tweaked cacophonies. Like the sort of Elon Muskian idea of free speech, which is that he and his like 22-year-old Silicon Valley computer engineers who are, you know, riding around the Bay Area on skateboards and like dreaming up brilliant algorithms, that those people can prioritize and demote and put in front of you and your kids and your family whatever they want to, and hide whatever they want to, and that is free speech, that is an open playing field. That to me is bonkers, and it's deranging us all. And so I see my role on Uncomfortable Conversations as trying to be a cooling pond for like our minds, and come together and take a deep breath and drink from a mountain stream and converse in real and bullshit free ways, and actually have dialogues and have the tough conversations. I think all of the imperatives are work against that, which means that I'm pretty safe in my job, because I don't think that conversations are going to get healthy before I die. So I'll always have the opportunity to try to remedy the way that we're having conversations, and to try to point out the ways in which conversations are failing. And I mean, sometimes I just do that with a monologue as well. You know, I'll sometimes do an hour long monologue, just noticing the ways in which we're making mistakes on both sides on a big issue like Gaza or something like that. I did an episode called Why Jews Are Literally Nazis in November, I think, after the Hamas attack of last year, which, needless to say, as you can tell from the title, didn't win me many friends, but it certainly got people to listen. And I think it was a good, I was proud of it as an attempt to speak in ways that both a pro-Palestinian or a pro-Israeli would be able to listen to and not feel like I was carrying water for one side or the other, without also being fatuous and both sidesy and milquetoast in what I was saying. Like, say bold, hard, difficult truths, but in a way that nobody can really deny that you're pointing to something valid. That, unfortunately, is just discouraged by all of the mechanisms of culture and technology at the moment. Like, you know, so much of what we consume is tailored for us by algorithms. We look at our phones and we think that we're looking through a window onto the world, but it's actually a mirror that's just reflecting back our own biases and preconceptions. You know, its only goal is to get us to maximize our time on the site and to engage with content, meaning to share it or like it or comment on it. And by definition, the kind of content that we're going to do that to is stuff that either reinforces what we already believe or demonizes what we don't believe. it's not going to be like a nuanced, sophisticated take. We're just going to swipe straight by that. Most people are. So the echo chambers exist everywhere. I think we've noticed them recently on the left, because the left suddenly went from being this kind of universalist rebellious place. You know, a generation ago, if you were a rebel, if you were a young rebel who didn't want to conform, you're on the left. Well, today you're part of the Make America Great movement, or, you know, you're following Andrew Tate or something. And the left seems very finger waggy and kind of censorious and bossy and schoolmarmish. So the fact that we're noticing the groupthink on the left, I think, is just a culturally contingent moment. But the echo chamber is affecting us all. It's affecting us in the heterodox space. It's affecting us on the right. It's affecting us in whatever community we're in. It's affecting me. I mean, the thing, you know, I have to spend every day working hard, I know, to not be inside an echo chamber. And I don't use social media because of that. I mean, I publish on social media. My producer does, but I really don't go in there, because I don't want to be bossed around by Zuckerberg and Elon. I'm sort of deeply pessimistic, but I also, taking the much longer view, think that the revolution of social media and the information revolution and the impending artificial intelligence revolution is going to change civilization, and probably for the better in the long term. And at the moment, I just see us as a newborn baby giraffe, all covered in placental goo, trying to stand up at the beginning of this revolution. And we, you know, it's like being at the dawn of the Gutenberg printing press or something. We just don't know where it's going to go. But the job of our life, the job of our generation, is to find a way through the madness of algorithms and the madness of crowds and come out with, you know, our heads screwed on. So that's what I regard my life mission as contributing to.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan. A pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.